This is the SF Signal Podcast. I am your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award winner. Tonight, I am ecstatic to be able to chat with New York Times bestselling author Brandon Sanderson. Mr. Sanderson's first book, Elantris, came out in 2005, and longtime listeners of this show will remember that that was the inspiration for John Anilio's song Serene, which appeared on his Sci-Fi Songs album. Following Elantris, we got the Mistborn trilogy, then the Alloy of Law, Warbreaker, The Way of Kings, and I think that was the first in a projected, like, isn't that, like, going to be a huge series, Brandon?
Yeah, it's going to be big. You don't grow up reading The Wheel of Time and Anne McCaffrey's Turn series and things like this without planning something ambitious yourself. The fun thing about The Way of Kings is I actually wrote the first draft of it, the first draft I finished. I'd started several before, in 2002. I sold Elantris in 2003, and my editor at the time, he's like, well, we usually like to do a contract for two books, so why don't you send me what else you're working on? Well, I just finished Wither Kings, and I'm like, oh, all right. And so I sent him this 400,000-word monstrosity of a book, like just enormous projected beginning of a long series, and he called me back, and I never have never forgotten just this sound of terror in his voice, and he's like, oh, wow, that's ambitious. Do you think we can cut this? Actually, when he said that, my response was, I actually don't think the book is right yet. I don't think it's ready yet. And so I let him off the hook, and I pitched Mistborn to him, and said, I'll do The Way of Kings eventually. And I had to rewrite it from scratch before I figured out what I was doing wrong. But,
wow.
But yeah, it panicked him that I wanted my second book to be this massive thing.
That's awesome. Now, speaking of The Wheel of Time, you were handpicked to finish that series, which is a daunting task for which I thank you. At WorldCon in Reno, I don't know if you remember, you were on a panel with Peter Brett and Brent Weeks. I had an interview scheduled with Brent. I walked up. Brent was talking to people. You were just kind of standing there, and I said, you know what? Thank you. And I just shook your hand.
I do remember that panel.
That was huge. And at the time, I felt like no matter what you did, you were going to have people who loved it and people who hated it. And I just felt like you were in a no-win scenario, you know? But I loved it. And my thing was, I purposely read trying to find, like, a line that was like, this is where Jordan stopped and this is where Sanderson took over. And I could never find that line.
You know, there's a couple of reasons for that. First off, I should say, before we get into this, it was awesome. Like, getting that phone call, it came as a voicemail message. I didn't know I was being considered. I just picked up my phone one day, and there was a voicemail from Harriet, Robert Jordan's widow. He had passed away just a couple of weeks before. And she calls me on the phone. I don't know her. I don't know him. And just leaves me a message and says, please call me back. There's something I want to talk to you about. It was incredible. The reason that it's hard to pick out is because of the way that Robert Jordan wrote. He was not a linear writer, at least on this project, he certainly wasn't. What I was handed was pages and pages of sentence here and a sentence there with an explanation here and an explanation there and a paragraph that I would drop into this sequence here and a line there. It's like there's no specific, here's where Robert Jordan stopped the book and Brandon picked it up. And beyond that, Harriet, Robert Jordan's widow, was also his editor. And she felt her big place in all of this was she wanted to smooth over everything and try and make the transitions very, very hard to spot, very smooth. And she's a fantastic editor. She was the editor of Ender's Game, among other books, long before she met Robert Jordan. And so she really knew what she was doing. And she was able to blend the voices together quite a bit.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I specifically read for it, and I never could find anything that felt to me like this was wholly his voice or this was wholly your voice. It was just, like you said, it was a blending, and it was so seamless and smooth. I will ask you this.
Uh-huh.
Did Matt become your favorite character?
Matt, I really came to love and appreciate. Matt, I've enjoyed always. But I'm one of those long-time Wheel of Time readers. I've read the books many, many times. And whenever I would start over the series, I'd be like, all right, I have to push through Matt being annoying. And I wonder if some of the Matt being annoying was in the back of my head for a long time until I started working on this project. Because I'd always had Taryn as my favorite character. But Matt was so challenging to write. And if you actually break down, particularly when Robert Jordan was doing his best Matt, which I think is in books 9 through 11, if you break down Robert Jordan's best Matt from a writerly viewpoint, something I've never done before, there's a strange narrative going on where Matt will say things and then immediately contradict them in his head. And then he'll think things, and he'll immediately contradict them by what he does. And what he thinks, what he says, and what he does tend to be three different things. And so he's this weird blend of an untrustworthy narrator who has his own consistency to him, but in bizarre and really fascinating ways that mixes together that make him hands down the most complex character in the series. And that was really tough to get right.
I don't doubt it. Now I'm 5 minutes in and I'm almost done with your bio. the only author to make the shortlist for David Gemmell Legend Awards 6 times in 4 years. You won that award in 2011 for The Way of Kings. You've also been nominated for a slew of other awards. And you did win in 2010, the Whitney Award for Best Speculative Fiction and Best Novel of the Year for The Way of Kings.
Yep.
2011, Whitney Award for Best Speculative Fiction for The Alloy of Law. And 2013, I got to cheer for you as you went up on stage and won the Hugo Award for the best novella for The Emperor's Soul.
That was amazing. I have to say, you know, I've read about it on my blog, but I'm a hardcore fandom geek, right?
Mm-hmm.
I started attending the science fiction conventions when I was 17. And the Hugo Award is always been, in my mind, kind of that pinnacle. There's a lot of awards. We like to give each other awards. This is one of the things we do just as people, and they're all awesome. Like, the Gemmell Award, I don't know if people listening know, that's a battle axe. When you win the award, they send you an engraved battle axe. I don't know, it's hard to top that for sheer coolness factor.
Sure.
But, you know, going to the cons as long as I had, and attending world cons as a 20-something, and dreaming of the Hugo, going to the Hugo Awards and watching people like Neil Gaiman get up and give these like eloquent speeches and things like that. It has been a lifelong dream of mine to write something that would potentially get me up there on that stage. So when it actually happened, that's kind of the, you have as a writer all these moments of I've arrived, right?
Like, yes.
You always kind of wonder, am I imposter? You know, you got the imposter syndrome. Like, when am I really going to be a writer?
Yep.
Like, it's still baffling me to look back and think of the writers I read growing up. Like, let's look at Tad Williams, one of my very favorite writers. And I loved, you know, Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn, and even some of his more obscure work, like Hal Benzauer and stuff like that. I was reading that in the mid-90s. And if I look at what I've done, I've actually published more books than he had at that point, where I was revering him as one of the greatest writers ever. But it's so weird to think of yourself that way. So anyway, you have these moments where you're like, wow, maybe I've arrived now. Maybe I've arrived now. Standing up on that stage, that was one of those moments where I'm like, wow, I have actually arrived.
I also produced Merle Lafferty's I Should Be Writing. And she was telling a story about an author who got a deal and his book was on the bestseller list. And when he got the email from the agent that said, your book is on the bestseller list, he deleted the email because he was afraid it was a lie.
Right. Yeah. 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 You have lots of moments like that as a writer where you're like, you know, maybe not, I'm still just kind of pretending, right?
They're going to figure it out. They're going to figure it out.
They're going to figure it out, yeah. They're going to figure out that, you know, I'm no Robert Jordan. When are they going to realize that?
But, now, you talk about some of this stuff with Howard Taylor, Mary Robinette Quall, and Dan Wells on Writing Excuses. And I have to say that as excited as I am to have you on, part of the reason I'm excited is because I now have officially had the hat trick. Because I've had Howard, Mary, and you on. All I need is Dan, and I've had all of you guys on this podcast.
Yeah, podcast. The podcast has been a real, real pleasure to work on with those guys. You probably experienced this yourself. It's taken on this kind of life beyond what you ever anticipated.
Yes.
And it's just gotten more and more interesting the longer I've done it because of the people I get to work with and have on and things like that. It's been an absolute blast.
Oh, yeah. People ask me all the time if I'm burned out or, you know, I've got 217 episodes on SF Signal. I've got another 160 on Functional Nerds. I've edited and produced another at least 100 for Myrrh. And people are like, are you tired yet? I'm like, no, because I get to talk to cool people.
Yeah, it really does keep it fresh.
Yes.
The guests are a big part of that. It's also why, like, when we don't have guests, oftentimes what we try to do is try to do kind of hands-on work. We'll do brainstorming sessions. We're like, all right, let's brainstorm an idea together, show listeners how we come up with an idea, and then let's go write that idea and then talk about the process of working on it. And when you're doing things like that, the process can be so creative. You can do so many different things, and you're involved with so many interesting people that you really, it's not something you get burned out on, at least not quickly.
No, and you guys do it in 15-minute chunks, which is great.
Yeah, when I decided to start the podcast, I started it because my brother came to me and he'd taken a class on new forms of media in his university course. And he talked about podcasts, and he came to me and said, hey, we should produce one. And he was talking, he wanted to do some sort of scripted fiction show, like an audiobook thing.
Sure.
Which really didn't excite me, just because it's not where my experience was. Now, granted, I could have learned it, and it might have been fun, but I felt that people were doing that in an interesting way, and I had practiced my art form. But at that time, it was kind of when podcasts were really exploding. I was listening to a number of them. I actually, my geek obsession is Magic the Gathering, and so I listened to a lot of Magic the Gathering podcasts and things like that. And I was listening to those. I was listening to some writer podcasts, some of the science fiction podcasts, and I found that the ones I really liked were the ones that were a little more tight with the time constraints.
Mm-hmm.
When you listen to, like, for instance, The Dragon Page, I felt was doing a better job of this than other ones I won't name, where there would be a bunch of friends who get together around the table and talk about a topic kind of for 2 hours, right?
Right.
Where they don't even really get to the topic. They'll have this great thing where, like, we're going to talk about this. And these are most of the magic ones. And then turn on the podcast, you're listening, and they don't talk about it. They talk about what they had for breakfast. And so I went to my brother and said, you know what, I would like to do the podcast, but I want to do it as a nonfiction piece. I want to focus on writing, because I get so many questions about writing, and I can't answer them all. I can't send people emails giving them all the advice that I want to give them. So let's start a podcast, and I want to format it kind of as a Crossfire style, quick, informative, on topic, with me being a host and then having very interesting and engaging people who became Dan and Howard, two people I knew that didn't actually know each other, that I felt could talk in an interesting way, but also be entertaining. And the whole pitch all along was I would kind of be the straight man and keep everything on target, and then they would be interesting and informative. And it happened that it really didn't need me to be the straight man. We played off each other, and it morphed into something else different. But that was my original pitch on the podcast, was doing it that way. And yeah, like I said, it became its own thing. And I'm not even sure what it is now, but I think it's awesome.
It is. It absolutely is. Now, do you tournament rules or chaos rules?
what do you mean, for Magic?
Yeah.
Well, I prefer to draft. Drafting is my favorite. And those who haven't ever played this game, drafting is kind of where you all get together with a bunch of cards. You aren't sure what they'll be. You open up new packages of them, and then each of you has to build a deck and play each other with them.
Sure.
Using what you just opened. And that's the way I like to play. I've been playing for so many years that tournament decks, tournament rules and things are fun, but they can be more high stress, and it can be a little less relaxed, depending on your play group. And I find that a draft kind of mixes some of the competitiveness with some of the more relaxed casualness, because nobody's deck is going to be awesome. Everyone's deck is probably going to have a couple of awesome cards and a bunch of mediocre ones, and it really relaxes me more.
Well, and there's nothing worse than starting to play a game and then somebody's shouting, wait a minute, that card's been banned.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to worry about anything like that, and the draft is kind of like a magic triathlon, because you have this thing where you're trying to choose your cards that will work well together, and that's its own skill. And then once you've chosen all those cards, you have to build a deck out of them using about half of them, and that's a different skill. And then you have to play the thing and actually win games, which is a different skill. And so it's a lot of fun for me to do it that way. If I'm not doing that, which I usually am, then I'll play casual. Casual, just, you know, anything goes, but don't be a jerk, right?
Right.
Don't pop out your $2,000 card and be like, oh, look how great I am. Play a bet that's fair and have fun with it.
A friend of mine did that. He slammed Scheherazade down on the table.
Yeah.
I wanted to kill him.
If I ever have those cards, I'll be like, you know, I'll have this deck at the side and say, if you ever want to play the unfair deck and see what it's like, you're welcome to have me bring that out. But once that comes out, don't complain when it wins on turn two.
Have you ever watched How I Met Your Mother?
No, I haven't watched a bunch of it. I hear good things about it.
There's a guy on there who, if you say something to him, he's like, challenge accepted. And my friends said you could not make a gold deck. You could not have a deck that was legendary and artifacts and multicolored, all five colors. And I did it, and I kicked their butts.
There you go. Those are my favorite, honestly. When I can draft a five color deck, even if it doesn't win, I feel like I've accomplished something.
Absolutely. Now, I had a couple things here I wanted to say. I've got Brian McClellan.
Yeah.
He just did something on Functional Nerds. Now, he told us that you teach science fiction at BYU, or you used to. I don't know if you still do.
Yes, I still do.
You still do. And somehow, he managed to take the class 4 years in a row.
Yes, he did. Brian... I can't really take much credit for Brian.
He praised you like crazy.
The first year, I think it was actually the second year, if you talk to him. He says, I don't remember in the first year. And I always talk about being the first year when it's really the stuff he was doing the second year. So he's probably right, but one of the earliest, one of his pieces just struck me as basically the best piece I'd ever had submitted in my class. And I'm like, whoa, you know, this is fantastic. It was just this wonderful story that I don't even know what he's done with it, but it was fantastic. And I then kind of narrowed in on him, and I'm like, all right, dude, you're going places. Let me give you whatever advice I can. But at the end of the day, he was already doing all the stuff that I said to do. Now I teach the class in part because, when I decided I wanted to be a writer, for sure, I was in college. I had always kind of known, like I had been writing as a teenager, but you never really know, I feel, as a teenager. It was when I was 21 or 22, 21, and I thought, I just need to be doing this. This is me, this writing thing. And I started writing books. I had never finished one before, but I finished my first one when I was 22. And it kind of cemented it for me. That is what I needed to be doing. But I had no idea what to do. I had no idea, you know, I could write the books. I could practice that way. And so I did. I wrote 13 novels before I sold one over the next 8 years. And I could do that. But the business side of it, I had no idea about. You know, you write as an artist. You write because you're passionate about it. But at the same time, once you sell it, when you want to sell, you become a small business owner.
Yep.
And no one warns you about that. There's no one out there. You take these classes at university, and they talk about expressing your voice and discovering, you know, your talent. And some of the better teachers will give you the hands-on sort of, here's how you create intricate characterization or whatnot. But none of them talk about, well, here's how you read a contract. And my last year at BYU, I took a class from David Farland, who's a writer out here. He writes, he's Dave Wolverton / David Farland. He writes in both names. Mm-hmm. And he had come up from where he'd been living and then offered to teach a class. And so he taught it, and he taught it very, half the class was professional advice. Half of it was writing advice. Half of it was, here's how you read a contract. And that class was the single most useful thing I'd ever taken as a course and any sort of learning experience I'd had. just seeing someone who's actually doing it and having them say, here's how you approach an editor. Here's how to not be an idiot when you approach an editor and not, you know, not be one of those people, but be someone that they're like, hey, yeah, I should look at this kid's writing. And that essentially got me published, knowing the bits of advice and just thinking of myself as a professional. It's more of a change of mindset. And when Dave moved away to Hollywood to try and get his movie made, they were going to cancel the class. But one of the other professors came and said, hey, Brandon, you've got a book deal. Why don't you take it over? And I said, yes. And now, what, 11 years later, I'm still teaching the last of things. So there we are.
And you're not wrong. I mean, that is part of this whole process that doesn't get talked about a lot.
Yeah.
And it bugs
like
me.
Dirty.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's like, oh, you don't want to talk about, you're an artist, you know, you got to do this
yeah.
and that.
Yeah.
I push people and I tell them, you know, listen to Writing Excuses. I also tell them to listen to I Should Be Writing, because what happens with Murr is when you're having those doubts and those feelings of, you know, I'm a fraud and people are going to figure it out kind of stuff. You listen to Murr and she's having the same doubts and you're going, wait a minute, it's
right.
not just me, and it makes you feel
mm-hmm.
better.
Yeah, and then, it's that change of mindset of knowing and meeting some writers.
Yes.
And realizing they're just like me. They
yep.
maybe have more practice and more skill, but they really are just like me. That's what works.
Yes. And then I also tell people to read Chris Rush, her Rush on Business. Because it talks a lot about contract and stuff.
Yeah, she does. She really does. And she knows her stuff.
Yep. Now, we've talked about all this other stuff when your publicist really wanted us to talk about this little thing you got out called Steelheart.
perhaps that indeed.
The number one New York Times bestseller, Steelheart.
Yes, the first time that I landed at number one without the sizable help from Robert Jordan.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
So, thank you. Steelheart. So Steelheart is a teen that just pitched this thing. It's old teen, though, so it's kind of for everybody. You get in this weird position where you write books, and people want to know who it's for. And it's for the people that enjoy reading this type of stuff. And, you know what I mean? Like, who's it for? I wrote a book that I thought was awesome. It's not like I sat down and said, what demographic can I potentially target with my widgets? You do keep audience in mind. That's part of being a writer. But at the same time, for all the talk of business, when I sit down to write, I lock the business person away, and it's the artist's time to write something. And so when people say, you know, we're going to market this way or that way, that's good. But at the end of the day, I just wrote this story that I thought was awesome. It's kind of steeped in my love of nerd culture, and in this case, superheroes, something I've never really approached. I've done a whole lot with epic fantasy, and I wanted to write a story kind of taking the tack of what if people started gaining superpowers, but only evil people started getting them. World with no superheroes, only superpowered, supervillains, if you want to say, superpowered individuals who take and do whatever they want. And that was interesting to me. I had the idea actually one day when I was driving down the road and someone cut me off in traffic, and my immediate response was the desire to blow up their car. You know, not with like a bomb or something, but to shoot energy bolts. I'm like, ooh, I had superpowers. Wouldn't that be great? It actually frightened me, because I'm like, wow, you know, I grew up reading all these books, dreaming about having superpowers, and now in this moment, I really feel that if I had superpowers, I would use them to blow up the car of this person who probably, you know, just not even paying attention, cut me off in traffic.
So the lesson
about me.
Yeah, the lesson there is never cut Brandon Sanderson off in traffic.
Yeah, don't cut me off in traffic. I'll try to blow your car up. just that immediate reaction, right? And so being a writer, you have that something that provokes strong emotion in you. Your immediate response is, ooh, that's good. It did something to me. How can I tweak this thing to make it do something to other people as well? And that was the inception of Steelheart, and this idea of writing the story. And I was on tour at that time. I got back from tour, and I wrote a prologue. When people say, hey, can you pitch Steelheart to me? My pitch is, read the prologue. If you read it, it's 5,000 words. It's a nice chunk. But that prologue, I got back, and it was one of those kind of purely creative times where I didn't give myself any bounds. I just wrote, and I wrote something to inspire myself. And what I came up with was this 5,000-word prologue about an 8-year-old boy who watches a supervillain rip apart the building that he's in. And it was powerful, and it kind of set the stage for the whole story. I wrote it in his voice, which gave me set the stage for a character for me, and I knew I had a book. That prologue told me I've got a book. And really, if people want to know what the book is, the prologue is what you need, what you would want to read. And the thing is, I had just agreed to do the Wheel of Time books, and I didn't feel I could do justice to Steelheart if I wrote it right then, because I wouldn't be able to do any sequels. I didn't even know if I'd be able to tour for it or anything like that. And so I took this prologue, and I set it aside, and I said, I will work on you someday, but for right now, I'm working on something else. And so it sat there and waited for me for about 5 years until I was finally able to release it.
Wow. That's a lot of patience on your part.
It's what you have to do as a writer, right? I'm sure you've felt this, or you've seen this on the podcast. A lot of times people who don't do a lot of writing will say, where do you get your ideas? When most writers are kind of baffled by this question, because it's like, well, I have way too many ideas to write.
Yep.
You should be asking me, what do I do with the 100 ideas I have for every one I actually get to spend time on? And you kind of learn, at least I have, what part of my process is. A lot of these ideas I file away and see which ones are still itching at me a few years later. I'm like, I really need to write that book. And that tells me that there's a passion there from myself that will hopefully lead to a great book.
That's awesome. Yeah, you know, I've heard people say before, authors, that the ideas are like the really nice cupcake sitting on the counter with the frosting and the sprinkles, and it's just sitting there going, eat me now. And you know, there's like 10,000 of those.
Right. You can't eat them all.
Yeah, you can't eat them all.
Right. And, you know, the thing about being a writer that is, I think, the single most important thing for new writers to understand is that in practicing, you are not trying to write the perfect book. You are trying to turn yourself into a writer who can write good books. You are trying to practice to transform yourself into somebody who knows their way around a story and can, by instinct, do the things that create good fiction. And it's a process. And in that process, perhaps you'll write the great American novel. That will be awesome. But for most of us, you spend years going through that process, transforming yourself into something that then is able to consistently write the kinds of books that you see in your head and getting them on the page. And because you've done that, a great writer can take, you know, the silliest writing prompt and will go somewhere awesome with it. Whereas somebody who hasn't practiced nearly as much will get the most amazing writing prompt and will be unable to juggle it and turn it into something great.
Now, there's something new that has kind of crept up a little bit, especially in the genre community. And I want to call it the George R.R. Martin syndrome, which is an author has to write. I mean, if you're not writing, you're driving your family up a wall.
Right.
And so you've got The Way of Kings, you've got Steelheart, you've got two different series that you're going to be working on moving forward. Does it ever even enter your brain to worry what the fans are going to say if you release a Steelheart book and they really wanted a Way of Kings book?
Yeah, I totally think about that. I really do. And this is because a lot of us, and George is the same way, were part of fandom for so many years. I know what it's like to wait for a Wheel of Time book. Mm-hmm. I know what it's like to wait for my favorite writer's books. And I think about this a lot. And the thing about it is, the more I've written, the more I've come to understand my own process. And for me as a writer, going from project to project, instead of writing on the same project over and over again, is what keeps me productive. If I have to go from one big epic, which I love, don't get me wrong, the big epics are my true love. They're what I'm going to be doing forever. There's a reason why I'm still writing 400,000-word books when, in perfect honesty, the shorter books are way more profitable. you talk to any writer who's doing books of this size, me or George or Pat, we will admit, the business person would say, why are you writing this? You could write four shorter books that all earn about the same amount of money in the same amount of time you take writing one of these epic fantasies. And it's because it's what we want to do. It's the story we want to tell. It's where our passion is. And so I'm always going to do these. But if I had to go from one of these into another one of these, every time I've had to do that, it's been like hitting a brick wall. And I sit there for months getting like 500 words a day or 250 words a day, just unable to feel a passion about the project. However, if I stop and I write something for 3 or 4 months that is different, like The Emperor's Soul or like The Hour of Law, and break it up so that I do something, when I get done with that book, I will immediately think, oh, good, now I get to go back to the big epic, and I get really excited about it, and I go and I start working on it, and the process just works so much better for me when I'm doing that. Now, I'm a very different writer from George R. R. Martin, and he may do it for different reasons, but I suspect a lot of writers who approach it are doing it for this reason. The Way of Kings I'm planning is 10 books, the Stormlight Archive. 2 sets of 5, so there will be a break in the middle. It's going to feel like 2 series of 5, but it's really 1 10-book series. And I need breaks in between each book. That's just how I have to write. Now, some writers, it could be completely different. I know Steven Erikson basically wrote the Malazan original series, 10 books straight in a row without doing much in between. And those books were high quality all the way through them. So his process is different, and it works wonderfully well for him to do that. But for me, I've got to switch.
I understand. Now, Steelheart is out in hardcover, audio, Kindle, everything. So people can go check that out. Now, your website, is that just Brandon Sanderson?
Yes, it is. And we have a brand new one. So people have gone to my awful website in the past. I had a mediocre website for many years. No putting down the people who made it. It was done by my brother and a friend of mine back when I started and had no money. And They kindly put this website together for pennies. And for years, I just kept that website because I was fond of it. And beyond that, I kept telling myself, well, Robin Hobb's website is worse. And George R. R. Martin's website is worse. All the writers have bad websites.
So yes, they do. Yes, they do.
And then Robin got a new website, which is great. And then George got a new website. That was the big deal. When George R. Martin changed his website to be a modern website, I'm like, oh, no. George changed his website. If he's doing it, I now have, like, the worst website among all of these people. All right, I'll take it. So we finally redid my website from the ground up. So it's not no longer an embarrassment. Now we can keep this for 10 years until it becomes one again, and then we'll switch.
I have been very critical because I'm a marketing director by day. I've been very critical of genre author websites. They are pretty bad.
We were bad at it. Yes. Yeah. I mean, even some of the really good ones are also bad. I don't know if I want to name names, but some of the great writers who have these really informed websites full of passes with information that's great, the website design tends to be bad. So yeah, you're right. And I bent before the weight of the knowledge that George R. R. Martin has finally changed his website.
That's great, though. I like the site. I'm looking at it right now. It's awesome. Now, this is gonna go live on next Thursday. So I know you're doing some touring right now for the books. Do you want to tell folks where you're going to be?
Well, the thing is, if it's going live a week from today, I'm actually going to be in New York City this weekend.
Okay.
But that's not going to do you any good.
Right.
After that, I'm only going to be touring locally for the holiday season. And then I'll be going back out on tour in March for the second Stormlight book, which is called Words of Radiance. And I'm not sure where the tour is going to take me, but you can guess I'll be at my common haunts. We always add a few new places, but I'm always at Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego, and I'm always at Powell's in Beaverton and the U-Books in Seattle. I'm quite frequently at Borderlands, one of my favorite bookstores there in San Francisco. So West Coast, you know where to find me. East Coast, we shake it up quite a bit more. I don't know the bookstores personally there as well, but I'm starting to know them. And so you'll have to just see where we end up going on tour.
And I see that in February, you are coming to Colorado Springs.
Yes, indeed.
All right, indeed. I'm gonna have to come see you and say hello.
Yeah,
I'm in Denver.
Yeah.
I'm in Denver. So.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. I believe that is the. Let's see. Is that the Superstars Writing Seminars?
I don't know. It could be. Yeah. Are you? Do you know Kevin J. Anderson?
Yes, Kevin is bringing me in for a day for Superstars. I was there at the first one actually that he did way back when. And I haven't done it for a couple of years. And so I'll be coming in for that to the Denver area. And I think that's the February, unless I've agreed to a convention there as well. But I think that one is Superstars.
Very cool. Okay. And do you do much social media?
I am fairly active on both Twitter and on Facebook.
Okay.
If you see tweets that purport to be from me, at Brian Sanderson, they really are. That's me. I tweet a lot more when I'm on tour. When I'm at home, it's kind of paradoxical. You would think that I would tweet when I'm by my computer, but I tweet when I have my phone. And so you'll see me tweeting on there. And we post a lot of stuff on my website and on both of those places, Brian Sanderson on Facebook. So I do respond and interact there if people want to get hold of me. That is an okay way, but it is like this modern social media. It's so easy to post something and not have it be seen. So if you really want to talk to me, send me through my website, but that takes me a while.
Very cool. Well, everybody should go check out Steelheart. And Brandon, I want to thank you for coming on tonight. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much, Patrick.
The city walls are covered with slime and sludge. It's difficult to find someone to trust. The shout took a hold of us and left us dead inside. Every scratch is agony where the pain will not subside. Oh, Serene, I wished I could have known. Serene, I'm sorry that I'm gone. Oh, Serene, you're the one I wanted all along. I found a friend in Galadon, the Dooladin. We organized a union from the denizens. Wash the walls and planted seed, scripted aeons of pure light.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal Podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal Irregulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal Podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.